Was there? Yeah. You know why they're there, right? Except where all the rich folks live. I'm sorry? No, I only teach for a living. I can't afford to live over there. Are you kidding? Do you think we make money or something? Do you think we make money or something? No, we don't. I know. We. Yeah. Okay. I've worked for $10 an hour. In fact, when I went to massage school, because I had to have money, I shoveled horse manure in stalls for 2 years. You do what you got to do. All right, let's continue. So we started with organelles of the cell the other day, and we did get through the centrioles and centrosomes, right? We said, you know, that they're tubular, that they have this configuration of threes in this kind of circle, and that they do change when the cell is dividing because it makes up what is called the mitotic spindle, which is responsible for pulling apart the doubled up chromosomes when a cell is dividing. Okay? The next one are cilia and flagella. These are mostly made up of microtubules, and they are what are called motile. In other words, they move. So, of course, everybody here has seen the paramecium under the microscope in high school, where you see the little things around the edges and they're floating around. You see these little finger-like things, right? That's cilia. We have those as well in us. And, of course, the famous one that we all know that is the flagella, of course, is the tail of the sperm that we see as part of the male ejaculate that, you know, causes meets up with an ovum and we get cellular division and we end up with an offspring. So let's talk about cilia first. They are short, they are hair-like, and they extend from the surface of the extracellular membrane, and each cilia is anchored into that membrane. So these are outside the cell to a degree. It moves in an oar-like pattern. In other words, it is stiff in the power stroke and flexible in the recovery stroke. So imagine you're paddling a canoe. My stiff stroke, I've placed the paddle in the water and I'm pulling it through the water. Thus, I'm creating energy and the canoe moves forward. And if I, everybody knows what a J stroke is, right? You use a J stroke, right? You can keep the paddle in the water and you come the opposite way, and there's no resistance until you reach the next part and you come through again. The cilia is the same way. It has a power stroke that moves one way, and then it becomes flexible to return back to the starting position again, thus not causing anything to move. In doing so, if we have a membrane, that's not very good. Throw that one out. That's not mine, I just grabbed it. If we had a whole bunch of cilia on here, if the power stroke were this way, and then the recovery stroke were back to this position, the net movement would be in that direction, right? Okay, so it has a power stroke and recovery stroke. The coordinated movement of many cilia causes the movement of fluid along the cell. So if, for example, you had a bit of a cold or you're a smoker, you have phlegm that builds up inside the lung tissue, and the cells of the mucosa of the respiratory system have cilia, and they move the mucus up out of the lungs until it gets to a point where your cough reflex recognizes it and we spit out the mucus, which is the whole point of why the cilia is moving the mucus up into the higher levels of the respiratory tract. Right? Ladies, fallopian tubes. That's how the ovum moves from the ovary to the uterus, because there are little cilia on there that move the ovum along as it continues through its pathway to get into the actual uterus itself. Okay. The other is called a flagella. It is similar to cilia but much larger. It usually causes movement of the entire cell rather than things on top of the cell membrane. It wiggles in a wave-like pattern, moving the cell forward. So on the top left, we see cilia. And that's actually a microscopic look at respiratory mucosa. So that's exactly what lines the pathways or the tubes networks of the lung tissue and the throat and so forth, the trachea. And then, of course, on the bottom, we have sperm, and we can see the long tails there that, you know, represent the flagella. So we see the flagella move in this propeller-like motion, moving the entire cell. And here we can see this back and forth movement of power stroke and recovery stroke that we get when we look at the cilia. Again, the responsibility is to move things along the surface, okay? Ribosomes. We're going to be talking a lot about ribosomes soon. But they are another organelle that are responsible for protein synthesis. That's a responsibility. And as I said last week, we're going to discover that everything is about proteins. So a cell is making proteins all of the time for lots and lots and lots of various reasons. So these are very integral to the production of protein which the body needs. They are small spherical organelles. They do not have a membrane. They're made up of two subunits, and those subunits are developed separately in a place called the nucleolus. Now, the nucleolus is the nucleus within the nucleus. So it's a little part in the center of the nucleus. So the nucleolus creates these two subunits. When the cell is not producing proteins, they remain separate as two subunits. We're going to discover when we take protein synthesis that when we are creating proteins, the two subunits come together. They create an afunctional ribosome, which then goes on to do all the things that have to occur when the cell is trying to create proteins. They can be free-floating in the cell cytosol, or they can be attached to another organelle called the endoplasmic reticulum. So we can see here is our large subunit and our small subunit. Because they're separate here, we're not actively making proteins at the moment, but if the cell is going to, the two subunits come together and play their role. There are two main components. There is ribosomal RNA, and there is ribosomal proteins. Enzymes, proteins. You're going to hear me saying proteins a lot, right? Okay. These two compounds work together to form proteins along with other RNA and the right amino acids. Does anybody know what the chain is called that creates a protein? Or better yet, somebody give me the name of the bonds. What's the bond between the amino acids and a protein? No, that's a different one. So when we build proteins, okay, how many amino acids are there? Does anybody know? 22. There's 22 amino acids, okay? And we put amino acids, we have to bond amino acids together that goes on to form very particular proteins, whether that's a specific enzyme or otherwise, okay? Well, so what happens is, this is a little bit of a jump ahead, when we want to create proteins, we have to have a system that takes two amino acids and fuses them together, bonds them together. That is called a peptide bond. Everybody remembers now, right? So if there's many amino acids bonded together, it's called a polypeptide, which represents the majority of proteins that get created in the body. So when we're going to discover that we want to make a protein, there is a recipe that says what amino acids need to be bonded together to create whatever protein the body or the cell is wanting to create, right? So I always use Joy of Cooking, cookbook, every page has a recipe, right? So your DNA is the Joy of Cooking cookbook, and every gene is basically a page in a cookbook that tells you what kind of protein to make. And so we access that strand of gene, and it drives the ribosomes to go and grab the appropriate amino acids, peptide bond them together to eventually become a working protein. Okay? So the two compounds work together to form proteins along with the other RNA and the right amino acids, and we will get well into that when we do protein synthesis. Free-floating ribosomes produce proteins that will be used within the cell, and this is kind of important. You need to know this because I do ask questions on this. So if it is a free-floating ribosome, it is responsible for producing proteins that the cell uses itself within its own metabolic processes. Attached ribosomes, remember we said that ribosomes attach to the endoplasmic reticulum, they're responsible to produce proteins that will be secreted from the cell or used to form the cell membrane. So free-floating create proteins that get used in the cell. Attached ribosomes attached to the endoplasmic reticulum, they basically create proteins that generally get secreted out of the cell. So a prime example of a protein is called mucin. What do you think mucin makes? Mucus. So that little bit of cold you have and you blow your nose and all that goopy stuff comes out, okay, you have cells in your mucosa in the nose, and they are actually producing that protein and secreting it out, which creates that mucus that we blow out of our nose. So now think of that from a microscopic perspective. How much snot do you sometimes blow out of your nose? That's a lot. And you've got all these little cells creating all these little amounts of mucus. And how many people here, right, allergic reaction, 1 minute you're fine, something happens, and whoop, you're full. Oh, my God, and you're blowing your nose, right? That's how quickly these things can be made sometimes. It's pretty quick, okay? So here we've got the two subunits here. They're together in this case, and they are actually creating an amino acid string, therefore a eventual protein that's occurring here. And as I said, we'll be talking a whole lot about this coming up. And this is if anybody here is on chemistry, I can't remember what they call these configurations, but it's sort of a microscopic look at what a ribosome actually looks like. It's functional working parts. For us, it's just interesting to look at. We don't get into that. So that being said, we did say that some ribosomes attach to an organelle called an endoplasmic reticulum, and we're going to talk about the endoplasmic reticulum. It is an organelle that is a network of tubules or flattened sacs known as vesicles, and they are interconnected. Okay, so we've got these flattened sacs that are interconnected, and you can see it here. So here is your endoplasmic reticulum here. You can see all these little flattened sacs kind of all sitting on top of one another. The walls of the tubules and vesicles are a lipid bilayer, which is very similar to the cell membrane. So again, a hydrophobic portion, a hydrophilic portion, and lined up accordingly to lipids lined up, just like the cell membrane, that creates the membranes of the endoplasmic reticulum. Because we said that the endoplasmic reticulum has ribosomes that attach to it that would make proteins that would leave the cell, we need to understand that, as I said, the recipe to create proteins come from the DNA in the nucleus. Okay, that's where the recipe book is. So it would make sense that the endoplasmic reticulum would share the membrane around the nucleus so that genetic material that was coming out of the nucleus to create proteins is somewhat protected, so therefore it doesn't get mutated to create proteins. So the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous or connected to the nuclear envelope. Now we can see here there is a cavity between these sacs, right? There is a space between them. You can see here as well in the diagram how it is continuous with the envelope that goes around the nucleus. The cavity between the walls contains a special fluid matrix which is continuous with the space that we find within the double nuclear envelope of the nucleus. So the fluid is continuous. Now, when we look at flattened sacs like this, we say that this is convoluted. In other words, it's folded many times over. And we're going to discover that a whole bunch of different areas of the body, when we get this kind of folding, what it does very well, it takes a lot of surface area and is able to package it in a very small space. So by having this folding going on, we can then say that if we were to spread this all out, it would have a significant amount of surface area, but we're able to, because of its convoluted nature, we're able to package it into a much smaller space, but still maintain the amount of surface area that is required. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Because of its convoluted nature, it has a very large surface area, 30 to 40 times that of the cell membrane. But again, because of this convoluted nature, this folded nature, therefore then we don't run into it taking up too much space. Segments of this endoplasmic reticulum have small granules, ribosomes, that are attached to its surface. So some parts of the endoplasmic reticulum have ribosomes attached to it, and some parts of the endoplasmic reticulum doesn't have any ribosomes. The area that of the endoplasmic reticulum that has ribosomes is known as the rough or granular endoplasmic reticulum, and it is the portion that is continuous with the nuclear envelope that we see here. And we can see the little dots which represent the ribosomes that are attached to that endoplasmic reticulum. please, we must remember the ribosomes are responsible for creating proteins. Right, okay. Where we have no ribosomes on the endoplasmic reticulum, this is known as the smooth or agranular endoplasmic reticulum. So some parts of the ER have ribosomes, the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and some parts of the endoplasmic reticulum have no ribosomes, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. The rough endoplasmic reticulum is the area where some proteins are formed and enter into the endoplasmic reticulum spaces to be processed and sorted. So that's something to understand, that when we create a chain of amino acids, peptide bonds, polypeptides, that's still not a functional protein. It's on its way to becoming a functional protein, but it needs to be processed. Part of the processing is to actually, I call it origami, is to actually fold the chain of amino acids in an appropriate way, and without those folding, you have a dysfunctional protein. The folding is vitally important to create a three-dimensional form which becomes a viable protein. Okay, but we'll get to that again a bit later. The rough endoplasmic reticulum also helps carbohydrates to proteins to form the glycoproteins. So those glycoproteins we talked about in the cell membrane, they get created here to go into the membrane and replace broken down ones, that kind of stuff. Okay, so you can see here these spaces in the endoplasmic reticulum are called cisterns. And again, we see the fluid is shared between the two. We can see the nuclear envelope in purple, and there are ribosomes on there. And we can also see all the ribosomes that are existing on the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And again, this is between the two. This is where a lot of protein production occurs, right? The rough endoplasmic reticulum works very closely with another organelle we're going to talk about called the Golgi apparatus. The Golgi apparatus is responsible for forming and packaging compounds because the rough endoplasmic reticulum, as I said, produces proteins that likely get shipped out of the cell to go other places in the body. So they have to be packaged to be shipped. It's no different than anywhere else. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and again, I ask questions on this stuff. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum is where we find lipids such as steroids, okay, fatty acids, and phospholipids. That's where they're formed. So those phospholipids that made up the bilipid membrane of the cell itself, they're created in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So the smooth is where we find lipids like steroids, estrogens, and testosterone, fatty acids, and phospholipids. It also stores and forms enzymes which help detoxify some of the chemicals such as alcohol and carcinogens. Again, what's an enzyme? A protein. You get the picture? Right? Proteins drive us. They are vital to our physiology. Right? There's so many things proteins do. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum and the rough endoplasmic reticulum act as transport channels to help various compounds access various parts of the cell as well. So we can see here, we have the nuclear envelope on the left. We have this convoluted foldings here, the cisterns of the endoplasmic reticulum. We have some smooth over here, again, maybe making some steroids. We have the rough over here because of the ribosomes. And they create proteins, and they package them up and create transport vesicles that have an immature protein in it, or maybe just a chain of a polypeptide chain of amino acids. It then has to go to the Golgi apparatus to be processed for shipping outside the cell. So, riddle me this. Oops, what happened here? I'm not sure what I did here. What's going on here? I didn't even know I had this button on here. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of cool. Okay. We're going to make a pair of shoes. All right? Yeah, we're going to make a pair of shoes. So, the first thing, what do you think we have to do to make a pair of shoes? Well, so everybody in the room here, I've challenged you to make a new pair of basketball shoes. So what's the first thing you need to do? A base? What do you mean by a base?
Something
Okay. Well, size is kind of important because you might be doing different sizes. We're going to design the shoe first. We're not concerned with sizes yet. We're just going to design the shoe. So I just gave it away. What's the first thing we need to do? Design the shoe. So we need to have a design, right? So to create this shoe, we need to create, make a design initially. Out of that design, then what do we need to do? Materials, right? Like what? Fabric, rubber, right? So you've got to now figure out for the design, what do I need to put together to create the design, right? Like you said, rubber, leather, vinyl, could be whatever, right? Okay, so we make the shoe, okay? So the shoe is made usually where? In a factory by people who stitch it, put it together, put it on machines that melt the rubber, like do all sorts of things to it, right? Stick it together, right? Make it look like a shoe. Because a shoe doesn't look like a shoe when it first starts, right? You got a roll of leather over here, you got a big hunk of rubber over there, and you eventually do things to it to make it a shoe. So now we have a viable shoe. Now what has to happen? Well, we have to do something before we ship it. We have to package it, right? If they're really fancy shoes, we put some tissue paper around them, right? And we put them in a box. So they're packaged, right? So what happens to the boxes? There's lots of them, so what do we have to do with them? Okay, maybe label them. Okay, and then we stack them, right? Put them on a skid. And then, unfortunately, the majority of our shoes come from, right, in terrible conditions in some cases. So how do they get here? Not a plane. Not a transport truck yet. A ship. I don't think we didn't recognize how important ships were until COVID hit. That's why we're short of so many things, because so much comes from ships. So we have to go from China all the way, in most cases, to the west coast of North America, for example, where all those shoes that are packaged get shipped there, then they get what? Sent to, we use the term, distributed, right? So, you know, a chain store buys them, like, you know, Foot Locker or whomever, and they order how many shoes they want and they get shipped. What's exactly, ladies and gentlemen, what happens when we create proteins? We have to have a recipe, a design. We have to have ingredients to make the protein. We then have to do, we have to put it together, and we have to fold it and bend it and shape it to make it viable. And then if it's going outside the cell, we have to package it and ship it to go somewhere else in the body so that it can be functionally used. Same thing, right? Okay. There it is. Somewhere. All right. So, the Golgi apparatus is an extensive organelle. It is usually comprised of several flattened sacs, anywhere between 3 and 20, depending on the work the cell does, called cisterns. They are layered one upon another, and they look like a stack of pitas, sort of in terms of, you know, that pita, how thick it is, right? I'd say probably like a bunch of naan breads, except the problem is a pita is hollow in the middle and a naan bread isn't, right? So the reason I use pitas is because they're kind of hollow in the middle. They are layered, as I said, layered. It works closely with the endoplasmic reticulum. Now, I said that when a protein gets created by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, it is the Golgi apparatus that does all the packaging and all those sorts of things. What is going on here today? Come on, why are you doing this to me? Good Lord. Guess I'm talking too much with my hands today. There we go. Okay, so we said that the rough endoplasmic reticulum creates these proteins and it has to go to the Golgi apparatus to get packaged to get shipped out. That means there's two faces to a Golgi apparatus. There is a face that faces the endoplasmic reticulum, and there is a part of the Golgi apparatus that faces the membrane, right? Because they go in from the rough endoplasmic reticulum and they go out to go to the membrane. The part of the Golgi complex that faces the endoplasmic reticulum is called the cis face. The face that faces the membrane for the shipping out is called the transface, okay? Between the two faces, the cisterns are called medial cisterns. So that would be represented here. We've got, here is the cis face here. So here we can see we've got incoming transport vesicles from the endoplasmic reticulum that are traveling into the Golgi apparatus to be dealt with. And then we have the transface, where secretory vesicles are going to migrate to the cell membrane, then through exocytosis will be released out into the tissue, maybe the blood eventually, to be transported somewhere else, right? Now, if the smooth endoplasmic reticulum creates hormones or lipid-based steroids, as such as testosterone and estrogen, we have areas in our body that produce those hormones, so that means we have cells there that are that have smooth endoplasmic reticulums that are creating said steroidal hormones, testosterone or estrogen, that then get shipped out from that cell and travel out to maybe the genitals, depending on, you know, if you're in puberty and things have to grow there, growth, right, stimulating other areas for growth and so forth. So this is all happening at the cellular level, but this is where it all comes from. Compounds produced in the endoplasmic reticulum are transported to the Golgi apparatus by way of endoplasmic transport vesicles, which are these ones here, the incoming, okay? These are the endoplasmic transport vesicles. They're coming from the endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi apparatus. And once at the Golgi apparatus, they meld into the organelle. They enter the GA, and they are processed and packaged as they pass from one cisterna to another. So as they travel through these pitas and these spaces between, they are continually packaged. And in some parts, as I said, the protein is actually folded in here to become a viable protein. If that's the case, if that's what's traveling through it. Once they're processed and they're good to go, they then are released as what are called secretory vesicles, which would then exit the cell. Or, because lysosomes have enzymes in them, which are proteins, right? This is where these lysosomes get created. Then they float around inside the cell to do things like dissolving bad stuff and getting rid of garbage in the cell and all that kind of stuff. The Golgi apparatus also transports lipid and protein molecules, which are transported to the cell membrane to help maintain the cell membrane itself, right? Because it's going to get old, parts get old and dysfunctional, so we need to replace them. The structure is found in most cells, but is really prominent in secretory type cells. Remember, structure governs function. If a cell is responsible for creating lots of enzymes and lots of secretions, it's going to have a fairly robust endoplasmic reticulum and a really robust Golgi apparatus, because that's what the cell is responsible for. Right? So we see it here again. Which face is this? Cis face and the trans face. So we see here is our endoplasmic reticulum, which these vesicles are being transported to the cis face of the Golgi apparatus. As it travels through each cistern, it gets further and further and further processed till eventually it's ready to go. And then it travels out the trans face to head over here to the membrane, where whatever was created is through exocytosis released outside the cell. Okay, any questions? And this is happening all right now, all the time, every day, every minute, every second. Yes? I'm sorry? So same idea. I just call it packaging and processing. So same idea. So whatever gets created in a strand of amino acids at the endoplasmic reticulum still needs to be matured and formed and so forth in order to be viable when it leaves the other side. Yeah. Now, there are a number of steps that happen in there, but we don't go into them. Lysosomes. They're membrane-bound organelles. Why would we have a membrane around the lysosome? To protect it or to protect something else? Right. Well, you're right. right? If it's got enzymes in it, those enzymes, they don't care what they destroy. They just destroy whatever there is. So if those were to be released out into the cell cytoplasm, then it wouldn't kill itself. It would kill the cell. So it needs to be membrane bound because it is of somewhat a risk to have it inside the cell with these enzymes in it. There are over 40 different hydrolytic enzymes that can be found in lysosomes. The membrane is crucial. It prevents the release of the enzymes into the cell, which would then result in digestion of the cell itself. If the cell decides it needs to die for lots of reasons, it can do a self-regulated death through autolysis. So it will actually stimulate the lysosomes to break down its membrane, thus releasing the enzymes to kill the cell itself. There are times when a cell needs to commit suicide, generally. Okay? This does occur in some normal situations, such as the regression of the mammary glands post-lactation. So, of course, after baby's born, the mammary glands get very mature to produce milk for the offspring. When there's no longer breastfeeding, those mammary glands go back to a more immature state. And part of that is the great number of cells that were created to create the milk that are no longer needed. So through autolysis, they kill themselves off to go back to where they were kind of before lactation started. Or the loss of the webbed area of toes and fingers and embryological development. Inside mom, when you're at a certain point of development, you can look at a hand and you will see the five phalangeal bones, but it's one web. So what happens is, at some point in development, through autolysis, the tissue cells between the fingers dissolve away, which give us our digits and our toes. Now, some people do have malformed webs, so they end up having existing webs afterwards, right? And if it's significant enough, they'll just do a surgery to kind of nick the web. No. It would be they might have skin up to the first interphalangeal joint type of thing. It's more common in toes than hands, right? Anybody here know anybody who's got webbed toes? Yeah, it's fairly common in toes, more so than hands. Webbed toes and webbed hands? Yeah. Aquaman? Right? Good. A merman. So, of course, because they have these enzymes, we can say that they are primarily used in cell digestion and defense. And, of course, this is done. So we talked about phagocytosis. So we do have these cells in our immune response called macrophages, and they'll go up to something that doesn't belong there, and they'll do those arms that will come out and engulf the product, whatever it might be. It could be a virus. It could be a bacterium or something. And then once that vesicle has been created inside the cell, the lysosome snuggles up to it, and then through the two membranes, releases its enzyme into the vesicle that the macrophage created and dissolves whatever the bad thing is in there. It could be a bacterium. Anybody here ever seen, you know, someone has maybe a little tiny sliver of wood or something in their foot and you can't get at it and you leave it there, and lo and behold, after a while, it disappears. No, the macrophages come and go, clunk, 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 get rid of it because it doesn't belong there. Sometimes it doesn't, but a lot of times it does. So this is the lysosome snuggles up, releases those enzymes, and destroys whatever is in that vesicle. The lysosomes bind and release enzymes, which digest the contents, whether they are food or foreign organisms. So the same thing is, you know, we talked about organelles, like they're a mini-me of us. Well, they have a system where they eat, and the nutrients within whatever they're eating, the lysosomes will dissolve them into a more chemical level for the cell to use. They also help digest non-functional organelles, because like everything else, everything gets old and dies and doesn't function properly anymore. So the cell recognizes that maybe an organelle isn't functioning well, so it'll build a new one and get rid of the old one. This is known as autophagy. In other words, self-eating. Okay? Once the contents have been digested, the usable byproducts diffuse through the lysosomal membrane and into the cytosol. And as I said last week, the body recycles really well. So even bad things like a virus, You know, it will use amino acids, broken down proteins of the virus for use in itself. The waste that remains is in the lysosome, where it is transported and excreted from the cell by exocytosis. So the lysosome destroys whatever it is and then goes over again to its own cell membrane and gets rid of it out into interstitial fluids for the body to get rid of, either through kidney excretion or feces or whatever. They're found in every cell. They are produced by the Golgi apparatus. Now, the cell has a neutral pH of 7. Okay, remember our pH stuff we talked about, right? Lysosomes have a pH of around 5. There's a lot of hydrogen in a lysosome. Okay, they are very acidic. This is due to the pumping of hydrogen into the lysosome itself. So we actually have integral proteins in the membrane of the lysosome that is continually, right, pumping hydrogen into the lysosome to make it that such an acidic environment. So we can kind of see it here. They're not sexy, they're just kind of round. Right? You can see here they got a single wall membrane here, and then we have these enzyme complexes inside. Peroxisomes are very similar to lysosomes, but they differ in two important ways. One, they are not formed by the Golgi apparatus, but are in fact formed by the endoplasmic reticulum. So lysosomes are formed by the Golgi apparatus. Peroxisomes are formed by the endoplasmic reticulum. Sounds like a good question, eh? Two, they contain different enzymes known as oxidase. They use a number of compounds to form something called hydrogen peroxide within the peroxisome. And we've all heard of hydrogen peroxide. Do ladies still use it to make their hair blonde? Didn't they? Isn't that what they used to use to make their hair blonde way back when? Yeah. Okay. Hydrogen peroxide is an oxidizing compound, meaning that it removes oxygen atoms from the various organic compounds. And in doing so, by removing oxygen, it actually destroys whatever it is it's oxidizing because it no longer has functional oxygen in it. Right? This is why when we use hydrogen peroxide on a cat scratch or something like that, it bubbles away because it's actually removing oxygen. The problem with hydrogen peroxide is if you put it on a cat scratch, right, when you think that you're disinfecting the wound, you're in fact actually oxidizing the normal cells around the scratch and destroying that tissue as well. And the reason I use cat scratch is because if you get a cat scratch, I've found nothing better than hydrogen peroxide to get rid of it, that burny feeling that a cat scratch gives you. Oxidation is especially useful in breaking down fatty acids in something called acetyl coenzyme A. And we're going to learn a whole lot about that when we get to the Krebs cycle and cellular metabolism, which is then used by the mitochondria to produce energy so the cell can carry out its functions. So it looks really similar. Peroxisome looks like a lysosome, except the complexes inside are more oxidizing compounds, but the same thing does the same thing. So sometimes the lysosome will get used to destroy something. Sometimes the peroxisome will get used to destroy something. Proteasomes, the continuous destruction of unneeded, damaged, or faulty proteins is the function of this structure. So it's not a perfect world when we create proteins. Sometimes they get created by the ribosomes, but they're kind of buggered up a little bit. And so therefore, they don't become a functional protein. So the cell needs to recognize, hey, you know, you're no good. So I'm going to break you back down. Because you're even though you as a protein, you're of no use to me, all those amino acids that you've got there, I want them back. All right, so I can use them to make another protein at a later date. Okay, so what it does, it contains something called a protease that slices the proteins into small peptides. Other enzymes then further break down the peptides into amino acids, which then can be recycled into the cell. So the cell recognizes that the protein is not appropriate, and then we start breaking it down. And one of the steps is these proteasomes, which starts breaking down these peptides into smaller packages where then they can be further broken down to release those amino acids for later use from other protein creation. The mighty mitochondria. Everybody knows this one, right? What's that? The powerhouse of the cell. You've all learned that, right? So this is where we find acetyl-CoA. And we see the proteasome here, and it's going to break down those peptide bonds to some degree. when we're trying to get rid of proteins that don't quite function. Okay, next. We're in week three. Woohoo! No, not yet. We're getting there. Oh, yeah. Don't you worry, I'll catch us up. So the next one we need to talk about, and that's why it has kind of its own set of slides, is something that we all know as the nucleus. And of course, I put it here as a bit of a joke. It is the be-all and the end-all, because it's the brain of the cell. It is the control center or the brains of the cell, and it regulates cellular function by controlling protein synthesis, right? Proteins everywhere. Okay, so remember, enzymes are proteins, and enzymes regulate cell reactions. Remember I talked about last week, you know, an enzyme can significantly speed up a chemical reaction. And without enzymes, reactions in some cases would take so long, the cell wouldn't be viable, nor would the tissue. So we need enzymes that really influence the speed of chemical reactions in the metabolic processes of the cell. So we constantly need to have enzymes to promote those and speed up those chemical processes. It also controls cellular division, right? We'll be talking a little bit about that too. Most cells have one nucleus. Some have two, like cardiac cells, while others, like skeletal muscles, have many. Why? Why would we need lots of... What would influence a cell to have more than one nucleus? Yes? Possibly divide several times. Why else? What else is it responsible for? So if a cell is having to create a lot of proteins, having a couple of extra nucleus, we can start making a lot more, right? Though many cells have their nucleus at the center of the cell, not all cells do, such as a skeletal muscle cell and a heart muscle cell. Why? What might happen to a nucleus in a cell if it was right in the center of what's occurring when a cell contracts? There's your clue. Yeah, might crush it. Right, we don't want the nucleus in the middle when the sarcomeres are doing this. So we put the cell membrane at the edge of the sarcomere so it doesn't get damaged when a cell is shortening or contracting. Okay? There are three main components to the nucleus. So we see it here. We already talked just a wee bit about the nuclear envelope. The nuclear envelope is a double lipid bilayer. Both are similar to the cell and the endoplasmic reticulum's membrane, right? Because remember we said that the endoplasmic reticulum shares part of the membrane with the nuclear envelope. So they're both similar, kind of the same, which is extremely similar to the actual cell membrane itself. It has pores or channels like the cell membrane, but these pores are huge, huge, and they have to be. We're going to learn that when we want to create protein, and I told you that the DNA material inside the cell is the cookbook with the recipes, right? Well, we don't want to have the physical cookbook leave the nucleus, because that might do damage to the DNA and therefore destroy its cells. So when we create protein, again, I'm jumping ahead just a little bit, we actually photocopy the genetic code to create the protein. Okay, so the DNA has the recipe. We're going to photocopy it, and the photocopier leaves the nucleus to go make the protein. And because it is so large, RNA, because RNA is what photocopies the genetic information to create the protein, because it's so large, it needs a huge hole to exit and go and start the process of creating a protein. Now, you might say, well, if it's such a large hole, does any DNA material get out? Absolutely not. In the molecular world, DNA is freaking massive. It is an extremely large molecule. that cannot leak out of the cell pore because it's so large. Yep. We're doing transcription. I love that stuff. I love translation. Oh, translation, transcription. Yeah. All right, don't worry. When I'm done with you, you'll know exactly what's going on. I promise. Okay? I got videos and everything. So that's what's important, is that RNA is in that process. So we need large pores in order for RNA to get in and get back out again with this transcribed message for what protein to make, right? And that allows it and still keeps the nucleus protected. The outer membrane is continuous, as we know, with the endoplasmic reticulum, and the space in the nuclear envelope is continuous with the space in the endoplasmic reticulum cavity. And of course, as I said earlier, this interconnection between the nucleus and the endoplasmic reticulum is vital, because this is where all proteins are created, in the relationship between the two. So we see here the pores, there's the nuclear pore complex, and this is where these RNA molecules would exit. Nucleic acids, the one that we know more than anything, we use the term DNA quite frequently, but there are actually two types of nucleic acids. There is either deoxyribonucleic acid or ribonucleic acid. Nucleic, because it was first found in the nucleus. That's why we name it the way we do. So there are two types, deoxyribonucleic and ribonucleic. The bulk of the nucleus is made of deoxyribonucleic acids, or DNA. That's what it's made up of. And, of course, we all know that the DNA, we say, has the code of life. So what does that mean? It means that it contains the recipe that makes every part of us. So that means almost every part of us is made of proteins, right? Because DNA is the recipe for proteins. Get any idea now how big a role proteins play? Genes, then, are what we talk about when we say the code of life. Each DNA molecule contains thousands of genes. Okay, in the strand of DNA, of the molecule. Genes are segments of DNA which code for particular proteins, and as a result, because they do have the recipe for the particular protein, they control the function and makeup of the cell and ultimately the organism itself. So as I said, DNA is the joy of cooking cookbook. Every so many pages is a new recipe, which gives you all the ingredients and the instructions to make whatever it is that is the recipe in that book. Genes are exactly the same. They give the code of what amino acids need to be put together to create a specific protein. And that's what the code of life is. So far, so good? No, we don't do genetics in this course. Yay! Even I find it confusing sometimes. Okay, so if this fly is a blue eye and that fly is a red eye, that means it's offspring, and yeah, no, not my cup of tea. So, this is DNA, okay? This is DNA. We've got this configured rope ladder, called known as a double helix, that represents DNA. We have a half of a rope ladder. This is RNA, okay? So DNA is the double helix, and RNA is a single helix. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we work our way through. But you can see that there is this configuration. And we might say that what we're seeing here on the screen on the right of the DNA is one gene that is telling us what amino acids need to be stuck together in order to make blah, 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 whatever it is. When the cell is in non-dividing stage, the DNA molecules are loosely formed and are known as chromatin. The best way, I don't know if I have a picture of it here or not, the best way to describe chromatin is a bowl of spaghetti. So you take a bowl, fill it up with spaghetti. Think of how many strands fill up that bowl. Of single strands of spaghetti fill up the bowl, yes? Each one of those strands of spaghetti is DNA. And it's all just kind of sitting in the bowl. And that's what happens in the nucleus. It's just sitting there in a non-dividing nucleus. Okay? Now, during cellular division, those strands of spaghetti, the way they are in the bowl, that's not good. Because the potential for those strands of spaghetti to get broken in cellular division is quite high. So we need to do something with those strands in order to safely have them move into a daughter cell to make that daughter cell viable as a normal cell. So during cellular division, the DNA molecule will condense upon itself with the aid of many protein molecules known as histones to form a chromosome. These little pearl gems here are histones, and they work as kind of like a glue that pulls all that DNA material and condenses it and condenses it and condenses it until we get down to this chromosome so that the cell can divide. So instead of a bowl of spaghetti now, we have all this twirled up, tightened strands of spaghetti into much smaller forms. Everybody follow me so far? Normally, each cell has a complement of 46 chromosomes. In other words, 23 homologous pairs. Homologous means that half came from mom and half came from dad. That's what we mean by that, okay? So there's 23 pairs of chromosomes in every single cell in your body. Well, just about every single cell. We do have some undifferentiated cells, but they still have the appropriate chromosomes in them. And that came the moment your mom and dad, their two sex cells got together, because a sex cell has a half of an appropriate chromosomal amount. So the ovum has half, the sperm has half. When the two come together, they then create a viable number of chromosomes, which then promotes the cellular division, which becomes the offspring, which is us. Okay? They're numbered 1 to 22, with the last pair having the designation of sex chromosomes, being one being called X and the other being called Y, and it has to do sort of how they look when they're being looked at. Okay? Now, nowadays with the fluidity of gender and so forth and these sorts of things, we speak about them slightly differently, but this is what we still think. Just before cell division, the DNA molecules double so that when the cell divides, there's enough DNA for two normal cells, and that's important. So we said we have 23 homologous pairs in a normal cell. If we're going to have that cell divide and create two daughter cells, which it will, one cell will divide to become two, we have to create two 23 pairs. So we end up with 46 pairs. So that genetic material has to double up so that the 23 pairs go to one cell and a viable 23 pairs go to the other cell so that both cells are viable functional cells. In other words, we're photocopying the entire Joy of Cooking cookbook. So you get yours and you get yours. So whatever proteins are required, you now have the recipes to make all the chromosomes that are all the proteins that are required by any living organism. Okay? The X-shaped chromosome is actually called a mitotic chromosome because it actually contains two molecules of DNA referred to as a chromatid, which are joined in the mid region known as the centromere. So when we look at it here, this mid area here is known as the centromere. It is at this point that these two will separate, going in separate directions to each of the daughter cells as the cell divides. We'll be doing mitosis and meiosis shortly. The reason we say there are 22 homologous pairs is because 1A comes from mother and 1B comes from dad and so on. The final pair determine if the organism will be male or female. Traditionally, we say XY represents male and XX represents female when we look at all 23 pairs together. Ribonucleic acid is the second type of a nucleic acid. Its role is to relay instructions from the genes to guide the cell's synthesis of proteins from amino acids. So the DNA contains the recipes. The RNA is the functional part that puts it all together to create a protein. Yes. 23. Yeah, what did I put? Well, it's 22 with the 23rd being the sex chromosomes. Yeah. 22 and the 23rd pair are the sex chromosomes, either XY or XX. Now, why do they both have an X? Why don't they both have a Y? What's the 2X? What do I have that you ladies have, but mine don't function? nipples. Okay? So I had a friend give me a book one time, right? If structure governs function, then why do I have nipples? I'm not going to use them for anything, right? I don't grow breasts. I don't lactate. It's because, what? Right. Right. So there is a point inside mom, we all look the same. We're neither male nor female. So the model, the initial model, has makeup for all the things that we are, including breast tissue, nipples, and initially inside mom, components of genitalia, which are don't really belong to either gender yet, our traditional sense of gender. So what happens inside mom, with a fetus, if is female with the right XX chromosome, then estrogen gets released, and those components that would eventually do become genitals, one way or the other, are influenced to become the traditional female genitalia. If they are an XY, then testosterone is released, and those same structures under the influence of testosterone start to mature and move into the direction of eventually becoming male genitalia. And the nipples get left behind because the model's there, but there's no need for them. Can males get breast cancer? Yes, they sure can. Working in the hospital one year doing ECGs, I had a gentleman come in and he was missing a nipple. And I'm like, well, were you born without a nipple? He said, no, I had breast cancer. And that was, for me, the first time I'd heard that a male actually had breast cancer. It's much more difficult to diagnose because what sent him to the physician is he was lactating. He started lactating out of his nipple. Now, you talk about, what's that? Yeah. I started lactating when I was 17. Yes. Why? Because we are driven by hormones. During puberty, right, this is why we struggle so much at puberty, is because our hormones are doing this constantly, right? So in some cases, in my case, a male, for whatever reason, during that regulation of hormones, estrogen got up, right, on me, and I started lactating. Of course, as a 17-year-old male, I'm like, what the hell is going on here, right? And all it was, you know, went to the doctor, and they said, just relax, and sure enough, over the ensuing months, everything leveled out and it stopped. I don't know. I think it can, yeah. To some degree. Well, back in the 16th century, people of royalty, the females never breastfed. You always had a wet nurse, right? You always brought a woman from the village and who was lactating, and they would feed the offspring. The mother never fed the offspring. Yeah. Could cause it, yeah. Yeah. Oh. So what causes a woman her breast tissue to become engorged with milk? Yeah, just the smell of a baby, the screams of the baby. Yeah. Baby's first response. Baby's worst response is the smell of mom. It recognizes mom's smell. But mom recognizes baby's smell and will, like that, I mean, the breast tissue is mature, it's ready to lactate, so why does it suddenly start producing massive amounts of milk? Because baby cries. And for those, of course, who have not had children, because there's so many young people in here, it's a hunger cry that you learn with your child, right? Yeah. And when they cry, that hunger cry, the boobs just go, because they're getting ready to feed the offspring. That's funny. So there's a pattern that we see when we look at the 23 pairs. So we see we have 22 with the 23rd being the sex chromosome. Okay. DNA is a chain of repeating monomers called nucleotides. So, we'll finish with this. You'll see. So, let's see. I want 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay. So, we'll come over here. We'll do this side. Okay, we're saying each nucleotide consists of three parts. A nitrogenous base known as adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine. Those are the only four. Okay, you need to know these. Yes, you do. Okay, a pentose sugar, which is a five-carbon sugar called deoxyribose, which attaches to each base in the DNA. Now, as a pentose sugar, 5-carbon, it is not sweet. Okay, it's not sweet, but it is a sugar. And then there is a phosphate group that alternates between the pentose sugars to help form the backbone of the DNA strand. So this is what it looks like. Okay, we can see here, right, we said we have a nitrogenous base. Adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. So each of these red ends are the nitrogenous base. There is a pentose sugar. Do you see a pentose? Yes, there is a pentose sugar that attaches to a phosphate group. Purple, 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 purple. It's upside down here, but it's right side up there. To look like that. Okay, so this is traditionally how you tend to see it in the books. We have thymine in yellow, we have adenine in green, we have cytosine in blue, and guanine in that red. The deoxyribose sugar, the pentose sugar, is in light purple, and the phosphate group is in dark purple. Everybody follow me so far? I'm going to get to that. I'm going to answer that question. Okay? Everybody follow me so far? Okay, we have a pentose sugar, we have a nitrogenous group, and we have a phosphate backbone. Yes, well, you see it more here, right? So it is the sugar that holds the two nitrogenous bases together, or facing each other. Yeah, so we have what's called a hydrogen bond in the middle that holds them together. So that we end up with that cross strand, right? Okay, and I don't want to fill it in yet until I get to the next part. Now, what's interesting is this whole DNA stuff didn't come to our knowledge until 1953. In the scheme of things, that's not very long ago, is it, really? It's not even 100 years. So in 1953, Crick and Watson hypothesized the configuration. They didn't even know for sure. They just figured that this was the way it was. Based on a double-strand configuration, which we all now know is a double helix. So think of a ladder, like a rope ladder hanging from a helicopter, and you take it and you twist it, right? And it starts to twirl around. Same idea. The alternating phosphate groups and deoxyribose sugars make up the uprights of the ladder. So this would be, let's say we'd have a sugar, and a sugar, and a sugar, and a sugar, and a sugar. And then we would have phosphate, 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 and phosphate. Okay? So, the alternating phosphate groups and deoxyribose sugars make up the uprights of the ladder. The nitrogenous bases make up the rungs by pairing and bonded by hydrogen. And here's what you really need to know. Adenine always pairs with thymine, and cytosine always pairs with guanine. Okay? So, I'm going to do this. So, we've got green, we've got red, and we've got black. Okay, so we're going to say A, T, and C. All right, so we're going to bring these out just a bit further. So what are going to be the corresponding rungs on the other side? Thymine, so that would be pink. What's on T? Would be A. And what's on C? Sorry, G, which we haven't done yet, which would be here. So this is G, A, and T. And then between them, we have, okay, those are always the pairings no matter what. They never change. That's the pairing. Okay? It's not uncommon for me to have a question that says, what would be the corresponding to this? And I'll put in the question, T-A-G-C-T-A. And then in the distractors, I'll have the appropriate list that goes with it. Yes? Yes. That's the sugar. Okay. The sugar is the deoxyribose is the sugar. It's a pentose 5-carbon sugar.
Okay.
Okay? Always. We see it here. And then we see it here again. Here we go. Here's our pentose sugar. Here's our phosphates. Here's our nitrogenous bases and then our hydrogen bonds. Okay? I guess let's just do one more. We'll just get the RNA done. Okay, now RNA is a single strand. So rather than a double strand like this, RNA is just one half. Okay, it's just one half. The sugar is not deoxyribose, it's ribose. So we still have a sugar, we still have a phosphate, and we still have a nitrogenous base. It's just that it's just one-sided, not two. There are three types of RNA in the cell. There is messenger RNA, ribosomal RNA, and transfer RNA, and we will go through those when we get into protein synthesis. There is one very distinct difference. They still pair, except that instead of thymine, we have a nitrogenous base called uracil. So if uracil replaces thymine, that means that uracil and adenine always match if there's going to be a match. Okay? So it's a single strand. It still has a ribose sugar, still has a phosphate backbone, still has a nitrogenous base, except that T is replaced by U. Okay? And there are three different types of RNA. There's only one type of DNA, but there are three different types of RNA, and all three of these are highly involved when we are creating proteins. You see, single strand rather than a double. So here is our messenger RNA, and you can see the uracil, which would replace the thymine. Here is the ribosomal RNA, and here is the transfer RNA, and we'll get into those way more. In both DNA and RNA, the genetic information is stored as a set of three nucleotides. The sequence of three is called a base triplet. So what we are looking at right here, if we just separate one side and the other, this is a base triplet that is known as a codon. Okay? It is known as a codon. The codon specifies for a particular amino acid. Remember I said the recipe book? So that means maybe A, U, and C represents phenylalanine. Or what's the famous one in Turkey that puts us to sleep? Tryptophan. Tryptophan is an amino acid in Turkey that makes you drowsy when you eat it. That is correct. That's why at Christmas, you always want to go lie down on the couch after the big meal. You're like, ugh. That's because of tryptophan. Interesting. Oh, it is? I'm possibly the copious amounts of wine and the fact that the kid said you up at like 4:30 in the morning, Santa's here, right? So what we're saying is that, just before you go, every 3 is a codon, and it represents a particular amino acid. So this is where the recipe is. In other words, a gene is a string of codons that, to create a protein, tells you which amino acids need to be connected by a peptide bond in what sequence so that we can create the protein that we're after. Okay? Okay? See you guys next week, I guess it's next week. Oh, we got a test next week, right? Yeah, I got to work on that. Yeah.
You gotta admit, it's pretty fascinating, isn't it?